Daniel Sheehan. He's a wonderful constitutional lawyer, people's lawyer all the way. Thank you, Danny.
Terrific. Thanks. Terrific.
Peace.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Now I'm a farmer and I'm digging. Now I'm a farmer and I'm digging.
Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon, probably. This is KBOO Portland, Oregon. We are recording our show for the first time ever in each of our own homes. Jim is yonder southward in, I don't know, where are you at?
Hey, Glenn, well, it's wonderful to be with you again.
Even New liberal? Just,
well, I'm absolutely west of liberal and east of needy.
That's right. And we are recording this with the help of Joe Wilson, who has graciously agreed to engineer our program. Joe Wilson has a production company, Bergman Production and Productions, excuse me, and we're very grateful that he has lent his expertise, because boy, we have needed it to get set up for this.
But it's working here. Well, it's great.
Yeah. And we are have a full show lined up. We'll have music breaks. And we will even have a garden stumper, even though there's not an opportunity for you to call in. But I've got a good one here. And as my wife suggested, we will mention it at the first of the hour and then try to remember to answer it at the end of the hour. So we're going to mix up our regular production schedule here, but roll with the punches. We've got our music breaks too. I've got some good ones. Okay, our garden stumper is pretty simple in the question, but the answer is a little more involved. Botanically speaking, tomatoes are fruits. How did they come to be classified as a vegetable? Okay, it's been going on for a while. Okay, up first, we've got our plant of the month, pineapple guava. It's been several years since we've talked about that, and if you've seen this plant around town, you may not have known what it is, but it's beautiful. Right now, it's in, full bloom, Jim?
Well, pineapple, yeah, absolutely. Right out here, we have some beautiful bushes of pineapple guava covered with flowers. It's really a striking sight.
Describe the flowers, so if someone does happen to see some.
Yeah, they have the flowers, petals are pink, the center is red, really, really dark crimson red. I mean, as I say, it's quite striking. Among the various attributes of pineapple guava are that the petals themselves are very sweet and very tasty to eat. I've often thought you could probably dry them, but they fall off the plant after a while, and if you could collect them and dry them, you could probably sell them for a really good price, you know, some sort of garnish on a salad or something. But they're really, they're very tasty. The plant has, after, of course, it has a really wonderful fruit as well as the flower petals. The fruit can be 3 to 4 inches long, dark green, has a very sweet inside and a more tart skin. The ones that I really like.
Would you normally peel it then? Sorry to interrupt you there.
Well, actually, what my partner Lorraine does is cut them in half and then scoop out the center with a spoon.
Okay.
But I eat the. I really like eating the whole thing, and if I and varieties that I particularly like have a are able, you can do that. Some are a little bit too tart, and then kind of an interesting piece of information about pineapple guava. I would have, if we had a garden stumper we'd have people call in on, I would have asked, where is it native to? It's actually native to Brazil, southern Brazil, and it was made popular by New Zealand breeders, sort of similarly to how they did with the kiwi, which is native to China, but they made it into the fruit that we all know and love. And the same thing happened with pineapple guava. So if you really want to go to the center of pineapple guava, go to New Zealand. That they have lots and lots of varieties. It's very available in markets everywhere. You know, one of the main fruits in the country, really. But here in the U.S., a lot of people don't know about it. I mean, most people don't know about it. It was kind of available on in markets about 25 years ago, and there were growers in California that had put in commercial orchards, and it got going down there. And then I'm not sure what happened, but it just kind of petered out, and you can't find it in stores anymore. But it's a beautiful evergreen shrub too, which is it's really deserves to be well planted in our northwest climate, maritime northwest. It's hardy to below 5 degrees. We've only had 1 year in the last 38 years I've lived here where it actually was killed to the ground. That was in 1989 when it got down to zero and the coldest temperature we've experienced. But at 5, we've had no damage at all to it.
What did you have to do when it got down to zero and killed it? Did it come back from the roots, or did you have to replant?
It came back from the roots.
So not a grafted plant.
Yeah, normally you can, I mean, right now, mostly what's available are grafted plants, but that typically the problem, you know, of that kind of temperature, we haven't had for a long time. So it's pretty safe here as a garden plant. And like I said, it's really, really a nice shrub. It can get to be 6 feet tall if you don't prune it. Some people plant them as hedges. I know a neighbor of ours that got several plants and planted hedges of them. Again, with beautiful flowers and tasty fruit, and it's pretty hard to beat.
It is a beautiful plant, I have to say that, although I haven't seen honeybees on it.
Yeah, and honeybees are not attracted to it, although there's some literature says that if there's around, they'll occasionally visit the flowers. And what's interesting to me is that even though it's not easy to tell what's pollinating it, we do get fruit set. In New Zealand and in Brazil, the way that they get pollinated is by birds who eat the sweet flower petals and at the same time brush the pollen around. Unfortunately, our birds haven't learned about this wonderful treat yet. I've thought about putting a big cage around some plants when they're in bloom, putting some birds in there, and then let them out and then see if they pass the information on to their buddies.
That would be an interesting experience or experiment.
I'm not sure what the Audubon Society would think of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I read online when I was researching the pineapple guava that you can, even though you harvest the petals, if you don't disturb the, whatever it is, the stamens.
The pistil, actually. The pistil? In the center of the flower is the pollen tube.
That they'll still get pollinated. But doesn't, so you can have your petals and fruit too.
Can eat your petals too. And have your fruit too, right? Yeah, most times when you plant pineapple guava, you should plant two. Either you can plant seedlings or you can plant grafted varieties. There are a number of varieties that are available. One Green World carries them. Other companies have them. They're and most of them will do very well in our climate. They ripen late, so people should don't get impatient. Let the fruit ripen until it starts feeling a little bit soft to the touch, which will likely be in our climate sometime in November. But they do ripen. I have a picture I took some years ago of snow on a pineapple guava fruit that was quite good.
Do you get fruit consistently?
Yes. Yep. Every year. And like I said, Lorraine, my partner, takes them and cuts them in half and eats them from the center. I eat the whole thing. It was interesting when we went to Brazil in 2015 we wanted to go see where pineapple guava came from, and they had some varieties they had developed, which were they were very proud of. But their climate and growing conditions are actually worse than ours, even though it's where it's native. They have a lot of pest and disease problems. So their breeding goal was to create fruit with a very thick skin. Here we had these fruit that were really nice size and everything. You cut them in half, and it would be kind of like eating an avocado seed and throwing the rest away, because the skin was so thick, you could only eat the very center of the fruit.
Okay, well, that's pineapple guava. If you see a striking bush around town with some pink and red, and there's some white, I think, in there too, that's probably what it is. Maybe go up and
try a petal.
Maybe you want to get permission first. Permission to pilfer from somebody's pineapple guava.
Pilfer petals, huh? Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it is definitely a plant that's worthy to be put into our gardens here in the Northwest, in the Maritime Northwest.
Okay. Well, we will now take our first musical break. The theme that I have for our music today has to do with home. Probably know why, don't you? Yeah, because that's where everybody is. But our first selection is from Charles Erlin, and to tell you the truth, I've heard it also pronounced Charles Erlin, even though it's spelled E-A-R-L-A-N-D. Charles Erlin, was an organ player, passed away in 1999, I believe. And this is from his Intensity LP that was released in 1972, I believe. And this is a Robert Lamb song, who was part of Chicago, but I've never found that Chicago recorded this song, but it's called Happy 'Cause I'm Going Home. Okay, happy 'cause I'm going home. Well, I've been home for a while. Although I have to tell you, being a beekeeper and a gardener, those are both kind of solitary pursuits, and hasn't been a lot of slowdown on either of those fronts. Jim, I suppose, except that you're not traveling, you still have lots to do.
It's been pretty busy. In fact, I'm surprised. I wonder what would, I kind of sometimes wonder what would have happened had we done all the traveling that we had scheduled. I haven't had a dull moment all spring and early summer.
Yeah. Well, I'm reminded of a saying, and I don't know how much truth this is, but in Parade magazine, which I still glance through, it doesn't take much time because it comes in the Sunday paper, the Oregonian, and they have, she used to be billed as, you know, the world's smartest woman or person, even. I don't know if it's woman or man, but Marilyn Vos Savant. Is that her name? I think so. And anyway, someone wrote in one time, she answers questions from people that wrote in. And one person wrote in, and this was more than a decade ago, saying that, you know, I'm in college and I get this assignment and, you know, it's due in 2 months and I put it off. And then the last week I buckle down and the last few days I get it done, you know, and turn it in. You know, why is that? And she said, and I always remember this, and I've used it several times, she says, because there's always enough time to do a bad job. Well, I don't think that's true. You know, many people work under deadline, and I'm probably one of those. But anyway, I don't think that has anything to do with what you would be doing out there on the farm.
We're always under a deadline that we're trying to catch up on. And this year was really crazy. I don't know if I shared with you, Glenn, about in our particular nursery field, the demand for plants was stronger than we expected. And because of that, we have a small crew. It's difficult to hire people these days. And we were our workers who should have been out doing some work in the fields were busy preparing plants for shipment and sale. So we had weeds that were like, I'd never seen so many large weeds in our fields. And we had one Sunday where five of us, including myself, came to work. We spent an entire Sunday pulling weeds that were bigger than the plants around them. It was crazy, but that's what we got, because we were on the other side. We were very busy and happy shipping plants.
Yeah. Well, it has been just a banner year. Some of the nurseries that I've talked to, one in particular, said this has been their best year ever. And they've been in business for decades.
Yeah.
And it's been the same true with beekeeping.
Yeah.
A couple of things have kind of getting off topic here, but a couple of factors here or there. Is that, well, people have time to not only garden, but to keep bees too. And it's just been a tremendous swarm year. Swarm meaning when the queen leaves with half the bees and then the parent colony will raise a new queen. But by my estimate, it's been, you know, as 2 to 3 times as many swarms this year as last year.
How does the king respond to that departure of the queen?
There is no king, Jim.
Oh. I should have known that, but anyway.
Yeah, she's it. There are drones which will mate with the queen, but we hardly consider them kings. In fact, they die after mating with the queen, so.
Not a good fate for a king.
Yeah. Anyway, we have reached July, and next month is also a very dry month. These are the two driest months traditionally for rainfall. We average in July, I think, 0.065 of an inch, just, you know, less than an inch. And I remember from my master gardener training that lawns require about 1 inch of water a week. So that's why I let my lawn, well, I don't have much lawn, go dormant.
Yeah.
Even though it hasn't been a hot summer so far. I mean, we've had some hot days, but it's certainly living up to its dry nature. Even though we've had some rain, we're still 7 inches behind or something on the water year. So we'll spend a few minutes now talking about watering your gardens, vegetable and fruit gardens or lawns or roses, whatever on that. But, you know, the main thing to realize is that it's better to have infrequent deep waterings than more frequent, just shallow waterings. We want the water to really seep into the soil, so the roots will go down far, rather than just, they think it's a cushy life. We're just going to, if there's water on the surface all the time, the roots will stay on the surface for the most part. So we want deep, infrequent waterings, maybe once a week. How much do you water, Jim? I mean, how frequently?
Yeah, you know, that's our rule of thumb, Glenn. Once a week, deep watering. And there's a difference between, of course, growing plants in the ground and in containers. And I think the listeners need to really to pay attention to that. I'm struck by that all the time here at the nursery, and I work with my colleagues making sure they understand how, you know, when you grow a plant in a container, I mean, you're basically in charge of its water situation. When you grow a plant in the ground, there's some buffer. If you miss a watering or you're a little something, you know, you go out of town and your friend doesn't water your plants for you, they're not likely to die if they're in the ground. But if they're in a container, they will die for lack of water. And that, like the, and so in a container, typically in hot weather, you probably need to water more often than once a week. My way of telling whether a container is well watered or not is by gravity. Essentially, I pick them up and see how, and of course, if it's a huge container, you probably couldn't do that. But if it's a container small enough for you to kind of heft it a little bit, you'll start learning real quickly what a container that needs watering feels like. It's much lighter than one that's fully watered. I should also say that on the other side of it is, it's important not to overwater. And I think in my experience, I've probably seen way more plants die from overwatering than underwatering. It's very, very common for people to think that with the surface of, for example, of a container plant, the surface of the soil, the pot's a little dry, I should water it. And the plant never gets a chance to get, you know, a little dry, and the roots just are constantly moist, and they will rot eventually from too much water. So again, the way I do it is by actually, you know, see if I can lift the pot. There's other ways of doing it. I mean, you can just feel the soil too, and if it feels moist on the surface, you're probably in pretty good shape. But like you said earlier, if especially with containers, if you just do a very light watering frequently, you can actually cause the roots to go up rather than down. Because that's where the moisture is, and they'll turn around and go up into the surface of the soil to try to get to that moisture. So it's important, even in containers, to water deeply.
We want those roots to be chasing the water downwards.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Think of it that way. And that's when plants are in ground, they have a much bigger reservoir of moisture.
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, it's pretty rare for something to die if it's in the ground. I mean, it can get wilted and it can get unhappy quite a bit. Die, you know, and you know, obviously there are fruiting plants here in Oregon, or you know, that people don't water. I mean, they survive and actually bear good crops. The hazelnut or filbert is one that in our region, it's now people have started to irrigate them, and especially earlier when they were young, to get them well established. But there's lots and hundreds of acres of hazelnuts or filberts that are grown without any irrigation at all.
And that's after their initial first year or two.
Yeah, and they are even grown typically without water in some cases the first year, but they're happier if they get some water.
Yeah.
They'll survive though. You know, grapes also oftentimes are grown without any supplemental irrigation.
Yeah.
But you can't get away with that with, you know, apple trees or peaches, or those plants will not be happy, and you won't get much fruit if you don't water them.
Yeah.
But I think another thing it's important to point out is the competition around the base of the plant. What I have also seen a lot of is if you take you plant a fruit tree in your yard and you let the grass grow, you know, right around it, the grass will pull all the moisture and nutrients away from the plant, and it won't be happy, and it can get quite in poor shape if you don't keep down the vegetation around the base of it. Different ways to do that: mulching with straw, putting down a cardboard layer, and then something, you know, bark chips or something on top of it. A simple way we do that works quite well is using I think I've told you about this, using weed mat or landscape fabric as a mulch, just to keep the weeds from growing around the base of the plant.
I hope that we'll have time to talk about some pest control, particularly slugs. And boy, I've had a heck of a problem with slugs this year, or early, you know, with the rainy weather in May and then another stretch in June. I just had a heck of a time with my carrots. In fact, I'm going to have to reseed. There are no carrots that survived.
Wow.
The first one, because they just get nibbed. nubbed in the nib, whatever.
Yeah,
it's just little tiny slugs, you know, 16th of an inch.
Yeah, I've seen those too. Yeah,
and I don't know that they take the bait, you know, the organic slug bait, what uses the iron phosphate, like Slug-O. I don't know that they consume that, and so I didn't follow my own advice to a large extent. To some degree I did, but the time to bait for slugs is before you plant, a month before you plant. The iron phosphate just paralyzes the slug, or excuse me, it kills they eat it, they go back home for the day, and then you know, come nightfall, I'm not feeling so well, I'm not going out tonight. So you don't see them. Whereas the metaldehyde baits will essentially paralyze the slug, so they eat it and they can't crawl away, and they get desiccated in the next day by either the direct sunshine or just exposure to air and light. But it's possible that if we have a day or two of rainy, you know, misty weather, that they can survive that, because it paralyzes them for about 48 hours.
You know, a method that we use, which is a little rough, but for anybody who's not a morning person, is just going out there and just picking them up.
We were
doing that on one of our beds, where we just take an empty container and just go out there, and even the little ones, they're really hard though, if they're only, you know, like you're about, you know, a quarter of an inch long, it's kind of hard to. You know, if you got fat fingers, it's hard to pick them up. But harvesting slugs is part of the routine here early in the morning.
I did that on my beans, and they, you know, they were just down to nothing till I really got a handle on them. And now they're doing well. They're 3 or 4 feet tall now, the beans. But I've also had problems with dahlias being decimated by the slugs. But so anyway, my advice for slug control is, in addition to hand picking, is to bait earlier than planting. So get them before there's any thing planted, and I think you'll be happier. So and dry weather helps a lot too. They just don't have the time to be out there munching when it's dry.
Because I'm a teetotaler, I haven't really gotten into using beer, but I hear every time I talk about slugs with people talk about, you know, beer, and have you had any experience with catching them? And
I mean, I hear that too, but I think that it's, you know, Jim, we've been in this business a long time, and a lot of times what you hear people say is what they hear, not what they do.
Well, you probably don't want to put out your microbrew anyway.
Right. And they did some studies, you know, I've read the studies that, you know, it's not the cheap beer that attracts them. It's the yeasty smell in beer that attracts slugs. And so they, because it's similar to rotting vegetation, which is attractive to slugs. And so they go in and they drown. Not that they intoxicate themselves, it's that they fall in, essentially.
It seems like another way too, which we sort of do by accident in a sense, is if you had some boards or something that you put out in the garden, and then during the day they hang out underneath, you know, in a cool, moist place until they can come back out again in the evening. So if you have a board, you put it out there and they get underneath there, and you just turn it over and you can harvest them.
Yeah, or slice them. You know, I've just gotten heartless on it. You know, I don't want them to suffer, but I don't want to suffer either. So. And there are, you know, there's other methods actually, I haven't heard much about copper lately. 20 years ago, it seemed like there was something to that about that slugs, as they cross copper, that the slime reacts with the copper and gives them a little shock that they find distasteful. I did an experiment once by putting a slug in direct sunlight in the middle of a copper band. And so it was either bake or crawl over the copper, and they crawled over the copper.
So the copper industry has been suffering since then. You discovered
and in the past I would see copper strips being offered in garden stores that you could line your raised beds with,
right?
And you know, put a band around it. But although sometimes they would say put an L shape to it, so they have to crawl over the top, an upside down L, if you will.
Maybe you're supposed to plug those in.
That would probably work better. Yeah, somehow charge
itself. What happened to your electrical system in your house? But
yeah. The lights are dimming, so
yeah. Well, that's anyway, definitely, you know, this year we I mean, it was noticeably wet early in June, and there, and that really did create some good conditions. And still, even now, I mean, it's, you know, it's, while as you say, it's getting dry. You know, it's not been very hot. And the forecast is not for particularly hot weather.
It's been very pleasant for the most part. But the plants are still using up the water. And you know, whatever sun we do have, of course, dries it off too. So pay attention to the water, pay attention to the slugs, and maybe we'll have time to talk about some other pests too, although those seem to be the biggest ones right now. Maybe it's a little too early for major aphid problems, but boy, I had a lot of aphids. But then I had a lot of parasitic wasps come in, and also ladybird beetles, ladybugs, that do a very good job of controlling aphids, but you have to have an infestation first. And many gardeners and plants, they just won't stand for that.
Yeah, we've had a lot in our greenhouses, but not so much outside yet.
Okay, well, let's take our second musical break here. This one is from Dave Alexander. I haven't played this this particular tune for a while, but boy, it's one of my favorites. And I've heard this from others besides my own household, that you know, people, particularly my wife, has had time to just make some wonderful meals. And I think that's the case going with other families too. And this song from Dave Alexander is called Good Home Cooking. And I can't remember what year this album came out. The Rattler is the name of it. Early 70s, I believe, too. So, Good Home Cooking from Dave Alexander.
Cornbread and buttermilk, hammock and peas. Pull your chair, brother, why don't you sit down and grease? Good home cooking. Make me feel so nice. Good home cooking. Take me to paradise. Pork chops and gravy and tender rice. Sit down, mama, let me tell you things be paradise. Good home cooking. Make me feel so nice. Greens and okra and some apple pie. Thank good soul cooking. Let me tell ya, hope to die. Good home cooking. Good home cooking. Good home cooking. Make me feel so doggone nice. Pigtails and collard greens cooked in fat back. Lay it on me, mama, don't you know? Just what I like, I said. Good home cooking. Make you feel so nice. Good home cooking, mama. Make me feel so doggone nice. Let's do it now.
Thank you.
Jackson serve. Country sausage on the side. Stack them up, pretty baby. I mean, stack them high and wide. Good home cooking. Make me feel so good. Ah, good home cooking, mama. Make me feel so doggone fine.
That is a tasty tune, pun intended. Dave Alexander, the good home cooking. Okay, what's... I'm just going to throw this in there now. What's been annoying me this month? Actually, this has been annoying me for years. And I'll just preface this by saying that these things just annoy me. It doesn't necessarily mean that I want them to change, although in this particular one, I wouldn't mind it at all. But it has to do with why... diesel trucks, and not so much the truck, but the diesel truck drivers, particularly workers, need to idle their trucks when they're just like cement trucks or whatever, waiting for them to do their job. And I understand that diesel trucks start differently and they need to heat up certain things to get the diesel to ignite and whatnot. But you don't need to idle it. I mean, you started it once, you can start it again. Isn't that, am I right here? That's...
Well, anyway. And just imagine, Glenn, all those diesel truck drivers, nobody can call you right now and tell you how much they object to your statement.
Nobody's ever called me on anything that I've on my what's annoying me this month feature. Anyway. That's annoyed me for a while, you know, yeah. Just because of the sound and the pollution. You know, even schools now have no idle zones for parents and whoever dropping off students or picking them up. You know, turn off your engine. And, yeah. You know, with modern day, at least gas engines, anything over 10 seconds wastes gas.
And you know, a lot of cars, it still surprises me, cars that actually turn themselves off and then you push on the gas and they start again.
Yeah, well, you know, you're talking to someone who has a 27-year-old vehicle, so.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, yeah, right.
Okay, yeah. Well, anyway, that's all the time we want to spend on what's annoying me this month. If you have something for next month and that you'd like to share with us, write it down when you think of it.
Okay. Right. Okay. Thanks, Glenn. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you have lots of things going on out at the farm, although I'm imagining it's somewhat between tasks here.
Things have calmed down a little. You know, the shipping we were doing went all into like middle of June, which was, I say, really amazing to go so long. But right now, well, actually, a task that I wanted to share with you was one that, and the listeners, was one that I did about a month and a half ago. Sadly, it resulted in my shoulder being hurt, which, because I probably overdid it, as Lorraine said. But we have a very interesting project with Seabury, where we are crossing varieties that come from Europe, where the climate is somewhat similar to here, with ones that come from Siberia, where it's cold and dry, and one they don't particularly like this wetter climate. So over the past several years, we've planted out thousands of seedlings. I think now we have something around 6,000 of them. Every seedling, of course, is a separate plant, and with Seabury, which is one of my very favorite berries, half of those seedlings are males. Seabury is a plant that has a male and female deal, so that that's how they get pollinated. Well, we're not trying to create more males. What we're looking for are females that have good fruit, less thorns, a more compact growth habit, a really nice garden plant. And we had the first group of these was about 3,000 plants. We had to remove about 50% of them, the males. And by the time we did this, which was about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, those plants had grown to be over 6 feet tall and were quite thorny. And so the task that I had was to, I had someone help me, and they took big loppers and we cut them off at the base, and then I carried them out of the field with big leather gloves and as thick a shirt as I could put on. didn't always work, but it was really, really very interesting project. And what we did with those Seaberry plants that we didn't need, we decided, couldn't figure out what to do with them at first. I thought, well, you know, I could chip them up, I could try to compost them. I didn't really want to burn them. And so one of our guys came up with an idea, said, well, there's this fence that's sort of broken down and deer are crossing into our fields. Why don't we just pile them up along the fence line? So we made there is about a 6-foot tall Seaberry fence line now. I don't know what's going to happen to it over the long term, probably get blackberries growing in it and stuff, but it was a good way to use the plants. And I think the deer now, before they jump it, they think, well, what's on the other side? They don't know.
how long is it? You said it's 6 feet high. How long is it?
Well, I think it was about 150 feet.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, that's a good way to use it.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty substantial.
I was going to try to make some comment on pierced nipples, but I'm not going to.
Okay.
Those plants, but
I had pierced hands, even with those leather gloves. Sometimes the thorns would go through. But you know what's really remarkable is that there are some plants that don't have either don't have thorns or are very little. So in breeding work, it's really a numbers game. You just need a lot of plants, you know, because there's most of them aren't going to be what you want. But because, you know, genetics are what they are, and you cross these things, you get, it's just, you know, tossing up the tea leaves or the cards, and what you get, so some are really interesting, and we're pretty optimistic about that. And I probably should also mention that when we're talking about pineapple guava, we have a similar planting of pineapple guava of seeds from Brazilian origin. And you know, there's probably 1,000 pineapple guava seedlings that are now in full bloom. Not all of them are blooming. Most of them are blooming. And our next job, one of our jobs will be to evaluate those. And again, we're looking for something that has really nice, tasty fruit, large size, and an attractive form. And hopefully we'll have some, you know, a new variety or two for our region in a couple of years.
I was going to ask, or I'm going, I thought about the, when you're in the Seaberry, when you're culling out the males, how do you know they're males?
When they bloom, you can tell from the flowers. And so I was really fortunate. We had our friend Andre, who comes, lives in Vladivostok, Russia, and comes to visit us in the winter. He volunteered to go, and when they were blooming, he marked them with tape, all of the males. Which was great, because then Lorraine and I would walk down the rows, and if we saw a male that we particularly liked for some reason, we would put another piece of flagging tape on it. Otherwise, all the rest of the males were removed.
What would you have seen that would cause you to flag it a second time?
A compact form, less thorns. Mm-hmm. Maybe some unique foliage. Some of the foliage is kind of really attractive, finer leaves, something that kind of set it apart from the others. Then what we'll do next year is we'll check those out again and see when they bloom, you know, because that's also an issue. You want to have ones that compatible bloom times. They're usually not too different, but you want to make sure that they're going to bloom when the females are blooming. Mm. It's fascinating, we have another group of about 3,000 that will do the same thing with next year. A lot of them bloom this year, but next year they should pretty much all the males should bloom, and so we can go through and mark those as well. And I'll let you know.
Yeah, that's like you say, you just need lots and lots of candidates.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, you know, because we have we call our nursery a plant factory, and we produce a lot of plants, and that's how we support our habit. But this research work we're doing is definitely doesn't allow for any boredom out here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not a factory. That's a breeding program there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads right into our dirtbag dictionary feature that we have many of the terms this time to define. And although we have lots of them here, we're going to keep it short. But have you ever stopped to think about, you know, just how plants become plants? And for the most part here, we're talking about plants that gardeners use, not just how trees come to be in a forest or whatever, but fruits and vegetables here. And so I wrote down a few here on, and we'll try to define all of these anyway. Let's see, heirloom seeds, open pollinated seeds, hybrid seeds, cultivars, seedlings, sports, grafts. There's probably others, but let's just take those one by one. So heirloom seeds, and Jim, feel free to chime in on any of these here that you're talking about. But heirloom seeds are just seeds that have been around forever. When they pollinate themselves, but they stay true to the seed. Many of these, or to the plant, many of these have open pollinated, will need to be, if the seed needs to remain pure, it needs to be isolated from others. The cucurbits, the squash and cucumbers are this way. If you let them open pollinate, they will. But what you plant will not necessarily be what you want. You don't know what it's going to come out to. So, but an heirloom seed has had the same genetics for, you know, generations or centuries even. Is that about how you would define it, Jim?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. That's somewhat related to open pollinated seeds. That is to say, they're just out there and they pollinate on their own or get pollinated on their own. You can save some of those seeds if they're open pollinated to begin with. You can save, in some cases like tomatoes, you can save those seeds and they will be, if they're isolated, you can save them. Lettuce is this way. Not the squashes. I've never tried really beets or chard or something like that, but they will form that. So hybrids are kind of what Jim is doing with his experiments with the sea berries. How did you start those plants, Jim? Did you just take cuttings from one or seeds?
Well, we had, so the plants, the varieties were originally from cuttings from somebody. Somebody selected them. Most of these plants are selected from the wild, and people spend years sometimes wandering around in forests and wetlands and, or, you know, big, all sorts of areas looking for something that's unique, and they find one, and then that becomes a variety. And so what we did, of course, was we took varieties and then propagated them, and those varieties we planted in this, and we planted for this particular project, we planted them on a piece of land near Goldendale, Washington, where the climate is cold and dry compared to here. So
they were clones then, essentially, because it's a cutting from an original plant.
Right.
Okay. Exactly. That's another way that plants get started, as clones.
Yeah.
So what's the variability then? Or where does the variability come in?
Well, the variability comes in because you've got a male from Germany pollinating a female,
okay,
from Siberia, and it's not unlike children. I mean, you've got all the every seed from that process is different. The 6,000 seedlings we have, every one of them is a different plant. There's not one of them is identical, because it's sexual propagation, not asexual. That would have been a good term, Glenn.
Yeah,
for asexual versus sexual.
How it's how these plants get started. That's great.
Yeah.
So cloning is another way, and that's essentially what grafting is.
Right.
You know, it's the exact duplicate of the parent plant, because you're taking a cutting from the parent plant and grafting it on, or in some cases just sticking it in the ground.
Yeah, I used to say, like, every red delicious apple in the world is the same plant. It just has a different rootstock. It's just growing in a different place, you know?
Right. Okay. Cultivar. Explain what cultivar means.
Well, basically it's short for cultivated variety.
Uh-huh.
So in a sense, it's pretty much the same meaning as variety, and what you were talking about is a clone. So a cultivar would be Granny Smith apple is a cultivar. It's a cultivated variety of apple. And people use that term, let's say, sort of simultaneously with just simple variety, but it is a specific selection of a type of fruit that is propagated vegetatively, not sexually. You don't cross-pollinate, like you wouldn't collect, you don't collect Granny Smith seeds and go and plant a Granny Smith orchard. You sexually, you asexually propagate by grafting the cultivar, and you create thousands of trees of the same thing.
And the last one that I have written down anyway is sports. And I don't know if this is actually a way that plants start, but it's a way that plants might, I don't know, Jim, what is a sport?
Well, there's people sports. Hey, sport.
Not so much these days.
Right, but let's put it, yeah, for plants, probably, I think the best definition of a sport would be a genetic mutation, natural mutation, typically.
Okay.
So, for example, the columnar apple was the very first columnar apple was a sport or a genetic mutation of a, on a branch of a branch of a Macintosh tree in Canada.
Aha, okay.
And it had a unique unique characteristic that the orchardist saw and thought that that was valuable. That was pretty smart because it was able, you could propagate it. And it, it's a very different form of apple. And the variety North Pole, which is widely propagated, is a is basically a Macintosh apple, but it is the genetic sport of that tree from that that Macintosh tree that, that was in an orchard in British Columbia.
Well, I don't know why they named it sport, but that explanation is great.
Yeah, I don't know either. Name, there's all sorts of names for things.
Yeah.
But that's but it's a very it's pretty common in the trade, and we always look for it too. For example, in the in these seedlings we have sometimes we will you know, you could call a sport. Let's say you plant out 1,000 pineapple guava seeds. You might have one that has variegated foliage. In theory, you could call that a sport of pineapple guava. A mutation is probably a better word for it, but it's a, you know, it's something that comes. It's not regular. It's an irregular form of that plant.
Well, that's a nice topic. We can maybe spend some more time on that down the line there. I want to give the answer to the garden stumper before we run out of time, just to make sure that we get this. So I'll repeat this, the question, and then we'll give you the answer here. Botanically speaking, tomatoes are fruits. How did they come to be classified as a vegetable? That's too bad we don't have a this live, because, you know, somebody could call in and win a tool sharpening from Coley Farm Store, but we'll figure out, maybe we'll figure out a different way to do that for next month here. But anyway, this information comes from an NPR story from 2013. Okay, that's many years ago now, but I'll just read this here. In a recent show, we talked about an importer that sold pillows shaped like stuffed animals. Or maybe they're stuffed animals that can be used as pillows. It turns out this distinction, is it fundamentally a pillow or a stuffed animal, is important because there's a tariff on pillows but not on stuffed animals. This feels ridiculous and legalistic in the way that a lot of 21st century stories feel ridiculous and legalistic. But it turns out this kind of thing goes back centuries. In the 19th century, the U.S. Supreme Court faced a similarly ridiculous question. Are tomatoes fruits or vegetables? At the time, the Port Authority of New York classified tomatoes as vegetables, which were subject to a 10% import tax. A fruit importer argued that tomatoes were fruits, which were not taxed. In the case, witnesses read from dictionaries, and definitions for fruit and vegetable were read in court. Also, definitions of tomato, pea, eggplant, cucumber, squash, and pepper. In the Supreme Court decision, the justices distinguished between science and everyday life. The justices admitted that, botanically speaking, tomatoes were technically fruits, but in everyday life, they decided vegetables were things, quote, usually served at dinner in, with, or after the soup, fish, or meats, and not, like fruits generally, as dessert. So, under customs law, the court ruled tomatoes count as vegetables, and the importer had to keep paying the tariff.
So that's fascinating, Glenn. I'm sure that's why Ronald Reagan said that ketchup was vegetable, right?
He had, well, he didn't have science behind him. He had the court behind him. So, but you know, it does bring up some interesting talking points about, well, there are no tomato desserts that I know of. You know, so maybe common sense prevailed in the Supreme Court in, I think it was 1893 that this happened. So,
You're making your thing.
I think we're getting close to the end of our time, and we will use our third and final music tune to go out here and just play out so we'll have enough time. I'm assuming that we have enough time for that. Our engineer says yes, Engineer Joe Wilson. Thank you again, Joe, for getting everything lined up for us. And this has been a remarkably fun way to do a show if we can't do it in person.
And I look forward to doing it next time.
We're using this app called Squadcast. I don't know, is it a pay for thing, Jill? Yeah, you have to pay for it. But anyway, it's similar to Zoom in that we can see each other. Anyway, our last song here is an old traditional song from Greg Allman, one of his solo LPs before he, I keep saying LP, but it's probably a CD. Before he passed away, it's I Believe I'll Go Back Home. So, Jim, thanks a lot for lighting the fire under me. I've just been so darn busy, but Jim said we can do this, and he had Fred and Joe, and we did it.
Well, Glenn, it's been a pleasure to do it with you. It's more fun to do it in person, but certainly better than nothing. And let's try again next month.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, I'll be here in town because where I'm normally gone for August, the Scandinavian Festival, of course, has been canceled. So I'll have to wait on my 42nd year of doing the festival. Well, I have Swedish pancakes. So anyway, this is Glenn Andreessen. This is the Dirtbag. Thanks for listening. We'll be back probably in 5 weeks this time, the second Wednesday of the month. Thanks for listening. Be well.
are listening to KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Esta es una sección especial en español en respuesta a la